From SGI USA, I'm Cassidy Bradford, and this is Bootability, the weekly series where I talk with Buddhists from all walks of life about the power we each have to change our lives and the world around us. This week, we asked you, what do you tell yourself when you have self-doubt? Some of you honestly shared that it's hard to encourage yourself in those moments. One person wrote in that they often first say very unkind things to themselves, but that they're actively working to change that pattern. Some of you said that you can't immediately encourage yourself with words, so you chant. One person said that they tell themselves, "My Buddhahood is very dormant today. Let me try to reactivate it." And then they sit down and chant. Many of you have some really powerful reminders that you tell yourself, like, "I have limitless potential." While others have warm ways to shake off the feeling, like, don't overthink it. When we're grappling with lack of belief in ourselves and the value of our life, there are so many ways to respond. It's honestly a journey to build a solid sense of self and the ability to pick ourselves back up. Today's episode is really about becoming a person who can cherish their life and take full responsibility for their happiness. Today's guest, Apoorvi Sahani of Denver, Colorado, shares how she won over deep loneliness and anxiety in college to become someone confident and self-assured no matter the circumstance.
My name is Apoorvi Sahani, and I live in Denver, Colorado. Currently, I'm working as a clinical assistant professor and the training director of the Master's Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at University of Denver, and I'm 29 years old.
Wow. Oh my gosh, 29, and to have this kind of, like, from my perspective, big accomplishment of your career is amazing. I'm excited to get into that a little bit later. Just to start things off for us, I know that you encountered SGI Nietzsche and Buddhism while you were actually still in high school, which is pretty amazing and, like, quite young. So I'm wondering if you could just tell me about that.
Yeah, that's right. I was in high school at that time, and my best friend actually used to practice, so she would often talk about it in school, and, you know, even when we would meet at home, she would, like, chant consistently, and she would really talk fondly about her mentor, Daisaku Ikeda. So I was kind of exposed to the practice a little bit just from her life, but in high school, actually had a breakup, which you can imagine as a high schooler, I was so devastated, and it just really impacted me emotionally, and, you know, it started impacting just how I perceived myself. And she really noticed how much I was suffering. She shared with me, of course, about meetings that were happening, but it wasn't until that time that I decided to go for one. I actually wanted to go to a meeting where she practiced, which was about 2.5 hours away, but wow. I took the metro and went there, and as soon as I entered, you know, I just saw such joyful faces all around, and I really enjoyed the meeting. You know, I was like, wow, I want to be happy like these people. And, you know, as everyone shares that everyone's battling, but it's really, you know, that life condition that we can bring forth even though we're challenging. After the meeting, a woman came up to me and she asked me, she's like, "Apoorvi, are you happy?" And I was like, "No, I'm really not happy. I'm battling so much." So she really encouraged me to test the practice, and she asked me to read our study material that we have and asked me to come to meetings and, you know, chant consistently. She really encouraged me to have that daily rhythm. You know, she described it as working out. We need to go every day to build our muscles. So similarly, we have to build our spiritual muscles. So we need to do it every single day. So yeah, I went back home and I decided that I'm gonna try this practice, and I started chanting. I remember, like, 5 minutes morning, 5 minutes evening. But honestly, I was not in rhythm at all, you know, like, my chanting was so off. And my brother sometimes would come in and he's like, "What are you even doing?" And I was like, "I don't know what I'm doing, but I know this feels good." So I just really continued chanting it regularly. And then, of course, going to meetings pretty consistently after that because it felt good. So, yeah, that's kind of how I started.
Wow. It's amazing that, yeah, from that point in high school, maybe because you had been in the midst of, like, navigating a breakup and in a very maybe tender place, just really finding, like, wow, these people are happy and I want to be happy. When you were like, okay, this is feeling good, I'm enjoying this, Were there any things in particular that you were chanting about, any goals you had, anything that you were like really using your practice for to kind of test things out?
Yeah, I think initially I just started to chant about wanting to feel happy. Like that's all that was on my mind because I was like, wow, what would life feel without feeling so low and unhappy? So I think that was my initial prayer. And I think two things that came out of it, which were very clear. One was this awareness that I would really place my life on the back burner. And then the second thing was, I used to have a lot of conflict with my mom at that time because I was very emotional and my mom tends to be more practical. And, you know, I was oftentimes labeled as the child in the family who was very touchy, overly sensitive. So, yeah, actually, maybe that was true too. You know, anything that would happen, I would just be so upset and then I would sulk and then we would have an argument about me sulking and that cycle would just continue. But yeah, I think after I really started to chant, I realized how much our arguments really reduced. And my mom actually pointed that out as well. You know, she was able to see that shift. And I think that was like a huge breakthrough for me at the beginning. So yeah, that's kind of how it started. And then of course, after that, one of my major goals was to come to the US to pursue my master's. And I really didn't know how that would happen because I was very clear, you know, that I don't want my parents to spend this money. And I don't even know how that would be even possible. But I was really basing it all on this practice. So I would chant Namyoho Rengekyo every day, morning, evening. And I would go and hang out a lot with my Buddhist friends in my community. So, you know, we would support each other. We used to study a lot from Daisaku Ikeda. And we used to share this Buddhism with a lot of people so they can become happy too. So because I was doing all of that and, you know, I started applying, I got admission into a university, which is University of Missouri. I didn't even know what that university was, honestly, at that time. It's kind of wild when my dad, you know, he came in the morning and shared with me. I was like, okay, we'll talk about it if it's like Harvard or Stanford or something. So I really didn't even know what I was getting myself into. But since that was the only university that I got accepted into, I decided to go. And again, at that time, I really didn't know how I would manage my finances. But once I was there, and because I was like basing my life on this practice, I encountered such an incredible advisor in my master's program. And honestly, I didn't even know she was such a central figure in my field. You know, I really feel it was all these protective functions really bringing me and her together. And she asked me to participate in research projects that she was involved in. And, you know, I would just take up anything that she would ask me to do and spend long hours just coding and doing anything that I could. And I remember walking in like the scorching heat, carrying these bundles of paper of manuscripts that we were working on because I didn't have a car and I didn't want to spend money on Uber. But I was just trying to exhort myself. Also, I got connected to my Buddhist community in Missouri at that time, and very quickly, you know, helped a few friends start practicing. So while all of that was happening, you know, at the end of my first semester, my advisor called me and she actually offered me an assistantship, which meant that, you know, I would get a stipend for doing research work, but also she ensured that I wouldn't have to pay any tuition for my master's program.
Wow.
So that was like a huge victory, right? I felt like, wow, if I can transform this, I can do anything. And, you know, I, of course, continue to really persevere, to do my best as a grad student and really so involved in my SGI community, which actually really helped me. It helped fuel me so much, right? And I think that benefit continued even into my doctoral program, where my advisor ensured that I had like full funding throughout my doctoral program and I didn't have to pay anything out of pocket and I was getting a stipend so I could live a lifestyle that I wanted. I could travel back to India, come back, and it was just so great.
Wow. Yeah, it's so amazing that you had this care from your advisor that you were able to, even though you didn't totally know the program or where you were going, but that it ended up, it sounds like, being, you know, a really wonderful kind of place for you academically. But I know that the transition to Missouri must have been kind of a culture shock, maybe shock to the system. So I'm wondering, like, as this, you know, in parallel maybe was happening, like you were working really hard academically, really successful, what was your personal life like at the time and what was your Buddhist practice like?
I was struggling personally. I was winning in my academics and work, but personally, my mental health, that was really challenging. Actually, right when I left home, I became aware of this deep sense of loneliness that was present in my life. And I think it was present even while I was in India, but you know, I was always around family, that it never came to the surface the way it did in Missouri. Yeah, I really battled loneliness, anxiety, and just, you know, feelings of sadness, which I hadn't ever felt before. And, you know, it would show up in such interesting ways that I felt like I didn't even want to go to a grocery store by myself. Or, you know, when weekends would come, I would like hate it. I was like, wow, what am I going to do? You know, these two full days without a routine or a structure. I'm going to be at home. It's going to be miserable. My eating was getting impacted. My sleep was getting impacted. And while everyone really felt like I was this most confident person, internally, it wasn't the case. I was really deeply suffering. And that really caused my family to worry a lot. You know, they were, of course, so far away in India. And they would call me up and they would notice how just sad I was. And they really wanted me to become happy. But I think even for them, just to know that I had this Buddhist community was very reassuring. Even while I was battling all of this, something that I continued to really do was, you know, connect with a lot of friends in the community, share this Buddhism with many, many people. So they can become happy, because we all are battling something or the other, especially at this age, right? Something is happening that makes us suffer. So I really continue to do that. And I just had conviction that this is the only way for me to break through somewhere. There was nothing else that would help me become happy. So yeah, that's kind of where I was. Very, very unhappy, truly.
Yeah. How did you, like, maintain conviction that this was the way to become happy when you're in the midst of feeling so deeply unhappy? I think for many people listening, it might feel like, well, why would you still, you know, feel like this thing is going to make you happy when you're still kind of really suffering? And, you know, in my own experience, I've also dealt like with quite debilitating anxiety and depression. And I too, like in those moments, still somehow was able to hold on to, okay, but I know that this practice is the key for me to overcome whatever is in my life and to become happy. But I'm wondering, in your experience, how did you maintain that conviction?
I mean, it was definitely not a linear process. It was a lot of back and forth of like redetermining and then, you know, a lot of setbacks. The reason I really stuck with it was because there was a group of people, right, in this community who genuinely cared about my happiness, which I never felt before, right? Genuine, without any ulterior motive, wanting me to become happy. So I think that was like such an important part of it. Like I mentioned before, I had a tendency to put myself on the back seat. So it was really hard for me to reach out for help too. I think that was a turning point where, you know, I was visited by a few Buddhist friends in my community. They knew I was battling and we had like a great dialogue. I don't really remember all that was said, but I just remembered feeling so seen and so heard and felt like they really wanted to fight alongside me to just become happy. They, you know, really encouraged me to read the writings of Nichiren Daishonin, who's a 13th century monk in Japan. He wrote letters to his disciples. So they really encouraged me to read letter number one, which is called On Attaining Buddhahood in This Lifetime. So I think that really was a turning point, you know, because until then, and I'll share more about the letter in just a second, but I think until then, I was kind of living in self-pity. It was almost like, why me? I'm the only one suffering. Everyone else is enjoying their life and I can never break through my career, finances, everything, but this is something that's never going to change in my life. But when I started to read On Attaining Buddhahood in This Lifetime, I think that really shifted how I even started viewing my suffering.
I think those two key components that you're sharing are so significant, I feel like, in being able to break through in our lives. One, having a community of people that really believe, not just like empty positivity, but have real conviction in the capacity of your life and that you do have the power to overcome. And that confidence comes from their own experiences of seeing the power of this practice. So I think for myself, I also experienced that, you know, even though I don't totally believe that I can break through, I trust these people who care about me deeply and believe I can break through. And because I trust them and they keep pouring into me, I'm gonna keep going. And then the second piece, study, is like people can encourage you and pour into you, but the breakthrough doesn't happen until you can really stand up. Studying Buddhist concepts really helps us do that and understand, this is how I can really stand up. So I'd love to hear a little bit of that writing from Nichiren Daishonin, if you would like to share and explain a little bit about like what resonated with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for sharing your experience too. So yeah, something that I want to share from that particular writing is where Nichiren Daishonin says, your practice of the Buddhist teachings will not relieve you of the sufferings of birth and death in the least, unless you perceive the true nature of your life. If you seek enlightenment outside yourself, then your performing even 10,000 practices and 10,000 good deeds will be in vain. It is like the case of a poor man who spends night and day counting his neighbor's wealth, but gains not even half a coin. That is why the Tendai school's commentary states, unless one perceives the nature of one's life, one cannot eradicate one's grave offenses. This passage implies, unless one perceives the nature of one's life, one's practice will become an endless painful austerity. Isn't that so incredible?
Yes.
Because my life was honestly an endless painful austerity, mm-hmm. because I was constantly blaming my environment, blaming certain people, blaming like certain situations that I was in. And rather than understanding that, you know, I have everything within my own life to break through, truly. Mm-hmm. So I think this was like the greatest shift that happened, that my life from time without beginning has been that of a Buddha. Right? Even with these insecurities, I'm still a Buddha. Even with these fears, I'm still a Buddha. Even with this anxiety, I'm still a Buddha. So, you know, I think this is something that I had to really drill inside my head and also start to live through my own life, which of course didn't happen after reading this once, right? I was actually reading this for 3 months every single morning. And because I was suffering so much, you know, at the beginning, I wasn't able to even read it on my own. I had a friend who would call me up every morning and we would read this letter together. So she would read one page and I would read one page and then we would discuss together. And it was after a month and a half that, you know, I was slowly able to really summon up that courage and start to read this and, you know, really get back to that daily rhythm of, you know, chanting and studying and, you know, continuing to really share this Buddhist with other people. So yeah, this really transformed everything for me, right? I think study is the greatest way. Without study, I think we're not able to refresh our faith. Daisaku Ikeda and Nichiren Daishonin have clearly written everything down, right? How do we need to practice? And honestly, until that time, I thought anything that is written in the Gosho or, you know, what Daisaku Ikeda said was almost like a fairy tale. I thought that it was true, but not for me. But I had to really believe with my own life that every single word, every single sentence is the absolute truth. And if I really, you know, look at their examples, they were able to break through. So I'm no different. Mm. I can also become happy. So I think, yeah, this was really a turning point for me.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think this illustrates so many kind of key things. I mean, definitely the significance of studying Buddhism and how when you're really reading it and chanting to really understand it, not just intellectually, mm-hmm. but really understand with your life, with your heart,
absolutely.
How that can shift so much, you know, deeply within yeah. you. I know many people that really struggle to believe in the value mm-hmm. of their life and, you know, mm-hmm. oh, other people, I believe other people can do this thing, but me, not so much. But at the core of our practice, when we're chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, we're making this declaration that, you know, my life has this unlimited capacity. Every time we chant, so even intellectually, if we don't quite believe it yet, if we're chanting to, like in your case, study this and really believe it with your life, you do actually start to believe it. How did you feel? And did you notice any sort of visible shifts in your life at that point?
I think it was so, actually, while I was going through it, while I was studying and exerting, sometimes I would question that, wow, nothing is changing. I'm still like feeling the same. But honestly, things were changing, right? Mm. I wasn't able to see it. When I was practicing in India, I used to have a lot of people come over and we used to, you know, chant together, just hang out, have a lot of conversations. But for them to enter, they had to come through my grandfather's room because they were coming from the backside of the house. And of course, my grandfather would greet them very nicely, but he was so unhappy, you know, with my practice. And I love my grandfather so much, you know, we're so close, but he was not happy. I would just, you know, jokingly tell him, it's okay, don't worry, you know, I enjoy it. And, you know, we would just move past it. But, you know, there was a time when he was really battling depression himself, you know, as he was growing older. And I gifted him a book from Daisaku Ikeda. And I really encouraged him to read it. And, you know, I really didn't think he would read it, honestly. And then, of course, I left for the US and all of this was going on in my life. And I remember it was like one winter or summer break that I was visiting back home. And when I went home, right before I was going to come back to the US, I was just sitting with him and really was crying that I don't want to go back. You know, I'm suffering so much and it's so lonely. I really don't want to go back. And, you know, he shared with me, he was like, Apoori, please go chant. I have seen you become happy. And I was like, what? This is so funny. And, you know, he shared with me that he also read the book that I gifted him, and he shared how much he respected my mentor, which was like so transformationary, like for to even hear that. And that was a moment, you know, for me to see that, wow, someone outside of me is able to see my life transform. So I just need to continue pressing forward. Yeah, I came back and, you know, I continue to persevere. I think slowly and slowly, I was able to break through, started realizing judgments that I held about myself, about people around me. So I moved forward. Then I like became aware of other fears. I was like, okay, let's transform this. Let's move forward. And so I think things were moving. But it was, you know, when I really finished my PhD and I moved to California, I really realized how much my life had transformed. You know, I really felt like it was 180 degree different from where it was, from feeling so lonely, helpless, powerless, sad. It had just become like, place me anywhere in the world and I can be so happy because I have my community, I have my gohonzon that we chant to, and I have myself. You know, I felt like as long as I have conviction in my life, I can break through anything. So it's not like, you know, sufferings are not there, like challenges are always a part of our life. But that shift, right, that human revolution that we talk about in our practice was so clear that I felt so secure. I felt so confident in my life that I was like, wow, this is what I was fighting for all this while.
I mean, that's like the greatest proof of this practice. Of course, all of these, you know, external victories that we have in society and career and family, those are also proof. But this kind of really deep shift in our life is just something that nobody can take away from you. Even if you, you know, were to lose everything, lose your job, don't graduate, whatever, you still have this kind of new belief in your life and this kind of rock solid foundation. So speaking of, you know, you're getting to graduation and you're feeling this way, what next? It's kind of scary to leave school and have to enter the working world. And I know, you know, you're an international student, so I'm sure there were probably aspects of that that were challenging. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, grad school was done and I was doing my residency for a year, which was kind of smooth sailing. And then I did my postgraduate at University of California, Berkeley, which was like great. And after that, it was like, what next, right? What's my job, real job now gonna look like? So so many challenges, I think, at that time. I was actually studying for this licensing exam, which was, you know, I needed that to really practice independently as a licensed psychologist. And also that was needed for me to get my visa to continue to stay in the US. So right when I reached Berkeley, you know, I started preparing for that exam and I took the exam pretty quickly because I was like, now I'm done studying. I just want to, like, you know, work and have a life almost. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in those initial days, you know, I would, of course, work a full-time job, study in the evening, and also really actively participate in with these activities. You know, we'd go visit different friends in the community, chant together, and I took my exam and I failed. Yeah, I failed the first time. And I was pretty sad, I think, after the first time. I think that self-pity mode kind of kicked in again. Like, why me? I spent 6-7 years trying to get a PhD here. And after all this, am I going to go back? So that's kind of how I was feeling. But, you know, I really continued to move forward. I was chanting Namyoho Rinkekyo a lot, morning, evening, and, you know, sharing this practice with a lot of people and studying a lot. I love studying. I think it's so important to study because that's what helps you put things into perspective, right? Because sufferings are never going to stop. So after all of that, you know, I decided to take my exam one more time and I actually failed again. But this time, you know, my life condition was so different. I was like, wow, okay, if this is the case, let me just keep moving forward, right? Like, I'm sure because, you know, I have such a sound philosophy, everything is like the Buddha's design. So that's kind of the conviction I had. And also at that time, I think I kind of had this like interest in wanting to pursue faculty positions, which I always wanted to do from the beginning. But I was like, who's going to put in that effort and go through the interview process? I just want to continue.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah. I was like, I just want to continue, you know, being a therapist and move in this direction. But I kind of was forced into applying almost. So at that time, you know, I started doing interviews. So it was like almost every week I would like travel and interview at places and then study for this exam and then go to work and then love spending time with my community. So that was obviously a part of it every day. And then I took the exam the third time, Cassidy, and I failed again. But I came out feeling so joyful.
Wow.
And I remember calling up my parents and I was like, oh, all right, guys, I failed again. And they were like kind of concerned by my response. But genuinely, you know, I did not feel swayed. So all of this was happening. And, you know, I was interviewing at places. And while I was interviewing, I was sharing with all my potential employers about this philosophy too. You know, how my mentor, Daisaku Ikeda, really wants to center humanistic education. So I was able to really share about that in each interview of mine. So it was truly joyful while all of this was going on, and I actually got an offer from every single place that I interviewed. Yeah.
Wow. It's kind of wild to think, like, failed exam three times. So you would think, oh my gosh, it's over. But then you got an offer from everywhere. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And actually, all of the places were willing to sponsor my visa. They were willing to do my green card process, everything. They were like, you tell us what you want to do. What do you want from us? And we'll do it. So you're like, wow, like, this is the greatest fortune, right? I get to pick where I want to be in the US here rather than feeling like I need to leave and go back to my country.
Wow. And for anybody listening that maybe doesn't have anyone in their life that has to, you know, find sponsorship, could you explain a little bit just like, I don't know, the struggles of being able to find that and how rare it is to have this kind of result?
for any international person, you know, finding a job, they need to find an employer who can sponsor their visa. And, you know, even though they sponsor their visa, that visa is valid for a limited period of time. And then after that, you know, they need to be able to sponsor their green card as well. And that's a long, long process. And the queue for every country is very different as well. It's a tedious process and it's a lot of money and investment on the side of an employer too. So yeah, just seeing that, you know, how each person was so willing to do that, I think was really the results of the way I was practicing, you know.
Wow. It sounds like after having this huge breakthrough in the way that you perceive yourself and value your life, then in turn, your environment really did reflect that. It's not that you were waiting for these jobs to validate you. You already were reassured, and these jobs are just a reflection of where you are already at in your life, which is really very beautiful and honestly kind of like poetic. So when you got all of these offers, how did you decide? What did you do?
I think all these places were pretty different in terms of geography. So I think that was definitely a factor, something for me to consider, you know, wanting to be closer to family and also wanting to be in a city after Missouri. Definitely don't want to go back to that kind of lifestyle. And also, you know, University of Denver is a university where my mentor, Daisaku Ikeda, also received a degree. That was actually the first place in the U.S. where he received a degree in higher education. So that was like even more meaningful for me. And also, I got an opportunity to be the training director of a master's program, you know, something I did not expect at all at the age of 28 at that time when I got this job. I was like, in no way is this possible. So I think, yeah, all these different opportunities and how they held personal meaning really drove me to make this decision and, yeah, bring me to Denver.
Wow. So how has it been since you started? How long have you been there for?
I started in September of last year. So,
wow.
Yeah, not super long.
Oh, my gosh.
It's been so great. I love my job so much. I love my students. And, you know, I think I'm able to really take, you know, our training in our Buddhist community and all the activities that we do into my workplace, right? For helping my students feel so safe, so seen, and just building relationships. I think that's just critical for learning. So, yeah, we have a lot of fun together. And I look forward to going into work each day and really feel like I'm able to create value wherever I am. You know, it's kind of interesting because my family and I joke about when I was in third grade, I was like the least interested in studies. I would score like zeros almost on all tests that we would have. So there was a time when, you know, I had to bring it back and get my parents to sign on, you know, the score that you get. So I could show it to my teachers that they've seen it and they understand that their daughter is doing awful.
Oh my gosh.
But like, yeah, with Cassidy, I wanted to hide it from them. So I started forging their signatures on the test results. So twice, you know, they didn't notice, but the third time they really saw that. And then,
wow.
You know, I was caught. And of course, my parents were very upset. But yeah, I think just reflecting back and to see where I am at today, you know, in academia. Yeah, I feel, you know, even more determined for my students to not have that fear, right? And to really enjoy learning, no matter where they're at. I really want to meet them where they are at and just support them as people first and then students and just be contributive in their life. So it's been a journey.
Wow. I mean, yeah, congratulations. Really is like amazing, I think, to look back and see like, wow, this is where my life has ended up so far. I mean, you're only 29 and there's still, you know, so much ahead of you. So, you know, I have just like a couple more questions, you know, now that you've started this job and I'm curious, like, yeah, what goals you have moving forward.
That's a great question. I think, you know, professionally, I'm really thinking about restructuring and reassessing the training program to really center humanistic education. With my position, I get the opportunity to really do that. So I'm really continuing to think about that every single day. You know, I want to also start a personal private practice eventually, which, you know, of course, I have visa challenges related to that as well, because yeah, we can't do that till the time you're a citizen. But I'm really praying that I'm going to break through that, because I don't want to wait. I just want to start as soon as possible. So that's another personal goal that I have. And I'm really looking forward to spending more time with my family, you know, having them visit more often, and then visiting India to spend time with my grandparents as well. And, you know, really praying for my future family. But yeah, I think also just so excited to build a life state where, you know, I can welcome challenges and really not feel like, oh my God, I really don't want to face it, and just understand that challenges are a part of life, and through my life condition, right, I can really win over anything. And just also make gratitude the center of my life. You know, I think that's something I'm really chanting about each day, because I really recognize that when we have gratitude, that's like a cause for happiness. So, yeah, I used to complain a lot, you know, thinking back. So I think that's like a shift that I really want to make, and I'm actively working on.
Oh, I love those two things that you're like chanting for in terms of like the life that you want to live or the person you want to be. I was listening to you thinking, oh, I want to do that too. I want to have a life state where I can really welcome challenges and feel excited by them, and also live with appreciation. Because you're so right. When we live with appreciation and gratitude, our life really opens up so much, and we can really connect with other people. We can just enjoy so much more. So I'm definitely taking notes on incorporating those for myself. So I think, you know, thinking where your life is at now, and even, you know, the vision for yourself in the future, I'm sure that there are people listening that are in a place that you were at some point in college, when you were really feeling deeply lonely and battling anxiety. And so for those people listening that are, in that place, I'm wondering what advice you have for them, whether they practice Buddhism or are curious about practicing Buddhism. Yeah, what would you share with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would just say you can transform it. You know, no ifs or buts. You can transform it truly with this practice. You know, I think the greatest way to do that is by caring for another life. You know, I think personally too, I was so attached to my suffering. I actually didn't even want to let go of it, because that suffering had become so comfortable. But, you know, by caring for another life, you have to bring out courage, right? For someone else to become happy. And then you start attaching yourself to your greatest potential. Yeah, I think definitely, you know, if you can really, you know, support other people, I think even in our communities, everyone's battling, even like a small act of, you know, kindness and support for other people really helps us break through. Lastly, I think is really give this practice a shot, you know, and if you're already practicing, like redetermine. There are three pillars in our practice, which is faith, practice, and study. So yeah, you know, I would really encourage you, whatever, you know, you feel you're lacking, whether it's study or whether it's connecting with the community or whether it's chanting Nammyoho Rinkyo, really identify that, because when you're able to have that solid practice with those three pillars, there is nothing, absolutely nothing that we cannot transform.
Speaking with Apoorvi, I was transported back to my early 20s, where my life was filled with self-pity and complaint. My mind was honestly like a battlefield. I would vacillate between criticizing others, thinking that they had no idea how hard my life was, to self-criticism, thinking, what's wrong with you? Why can't you just get over this? It's not that bad. But with time, I was able to shift my perspective on my problems. Daisaku Ikeda says, in the course of life, we face unexpected difficulties that make us wonder, why me? Why now? But the most challenging times are crucial moments, opportunities for doing our human revolution. The tougher our circumstances, the more we need to chant the lion's roar of Nam-myoho Renge Kyo and continue forging ahead with courage. By doing so, we accumulate solid good fortune and expand our life state. Turning everything into a springboard for attaining Buddhahood in this lifetime is the way of wise practitioners in Nichiren Buddhism. Because Apurvi continued to chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo throughout her moments of loneliness and sadness, she could finally believe in her Buddha ability and become someone with immense strength and self-assurance. If you'd like to get connected to a Buddhist community near you, just reach out to us at connect@buddhability.org. For next week, we want to know what you think is most important to living a healthy life. You can email us or keep a lookout next week for our Instagram story to share your response. Until next time, thanks for listening.